My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me. And I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It could look like anyone.
Help! Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes you. See Santa Claus tonight, you better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're gonna die for some chickens.
Someone is.
The symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence?
You don't think this is strange?
Hello, welcome once again to Discussion, a place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going?
I'm well.
Excellent. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Hey, Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
I'm doing all right. And in, well, actually, a Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy coming to you live from Danbury, Connecticut, where a whole truck full of nails just spilled on one of the roads that I drive to for work. So I am fully expecting to have a flat tire tomorrow.
How about that?
There you go. Pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, the day and the life.
Can't make this up, folks.
No, you can't.
Well, you know, it happens. So, let's see who we are. We are Dark Discussions Podcast. We discuss horror film and sci-fi, fantasy thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, art house, grindhouse, midnight movies, cult films, and whatnot, where we try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. Now, Eric, where can folks find us?
Oh, sorry. You caught me off guard. They can find us at our website, darkdiscussions.com. On that page, you can find every single episode of the podcast, as well as all of its spinoffs, as well as an article section and a link to our Patreon page if you care to contribute to the podcast.
Excellent, excellent. And we also have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, where you can email us and we will read your podcast on an episode, as well as take any suggestions, opinions, movies you would like us to talk about, or your thoughts on films that you've just seen that we haven't talked about, or just films that we have talked about and what you feel about those films or what we've said about those films. We also have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. Book group where you can discuss and dissect anything you want. So a lot of stuff being discussed over there, and that's pretty much it there. We did get a review. It's only one word, but it's a review, and it's on Podbean, which I didn't even know our podcast was linked to Podbean, but I guess it is. And the gentleman, I don't know his name because I have to log in and create a username, because I don't think I have one. But I see his picture here, and it's some guy, and he is talking about a Westworld podcast, Bullets, Brothels, and Bots, season wrap-up episode. And he wrote, excellent. And that was all right,
cool.
Yesterday. Yeah, so that is
one,
cool.
One word could go either way.
No, because
it's really hard. It's really hard to be give a good criticism with one word. I mean,
no, not really.
Well,
yeah, I'm with Eric on that. You just say crap. That
yeah, but
exactly.
Is it? But is that reviewing the episode? Is that reviewing the hour episode? Is it excellent? Like I just shit my pants. I don't know. I mean,
wow, what the hell's going on?
What happened?
I don't know. You just started talking about shit in your pants.
Well,
yeah,
either way, I'm
saying positive, so crap. What? Matter. I'm just saying crap alone needs a little bit of context. Understand? We're excellent. We can just take and run with it.
And that's what we can do. So he enjoyed our Bullets, Brothels, and Bots Westworld podcast, the season wrap-up episode for season two. And so we appreciate that. And that's just one of the number of spinoff podcasts that are done from Dark Discussions, including You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, Game of Thrones podcast, and then Searching for American Gods, American Gods TV show podcast. I think that's it. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up? Chrissy, I do want to ask, even though this is more news for the end, because we'll talk about our what we've been watching and things of that nature, but you had some exciting news. What has it been 2 weeks now? A new thing has been released?
Yes. My short story collection, The Shadows Behind, was released on April 30th. I had a very successful, really awesome book launch party at my house with a lot of my friends around me, and it was really amazing. And I'm very excited about this collection. There are no professional reviews available yet, but I have gotten the buzz that a couple of the reviews that are coming down the pike are very good, so I'm very excited about that. Our listener, Michelle Barkley, officially got the very first copy that was ever sold. That I know for a fact. And I was able to write that in her book, and that made me really happy. So it's got quite a few stories in it. Some of them, if you are on my Christmas card list, where you get a story every Christmas, because that's my Christmas card, only two of those.
I do.
Yep, you do. Well, only two of those are from my Christmas cards. The rest are favorites that from, you know, my fans or whatever that are long out of print and no longer available. I'm sorry, what?
Not anymore. They're in print now.
Now they're in print again. Yeah, they are in print again. Like How I Learned to Stop Complaining and Love the Bunny, which is a perennial favorite, and it's been out of print for, oh my God, almost a dozen years now. So that was really awesome that got back into print, and the rest are new. So if you would like to find out more about that or get a signed copy directly from me, you can head over to my website at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com, or you can get it on Amazon. Just Google The Shadows Behind with the last name Schoonover or Peterson, and it should pop right up. And also, we are going to be doing a Patreon giveaway. I'm going to be giving out four copies over the next year. So if you donate to Patreon each quarter, your name will go into the hat to possibly win a free copy. So please donate to Patreon, because it helps us keep this podcast running. It is really expensive to keep up the website and pay for all the gigs that to support the audio and other various expenses that help keep this podcast going. So please help us out. And like I said, for the next year, the next four quarters, your name will go into a hat and you might have an opportunity to win a free copy of The Shadows Behind.
Yeah, that's awesome. So not only do you have a chance to have your film chosen as a topic by Dark Discussions through Patreon, every contributor to Patreon, active contributor to Patreon, has a chance to get a signed copy of the book. For folks who do buy it on Amazon that would like to have it signed, there'll be a couple spots you can do that. One, as Chrissy said, you can email her, and if you don't know how to spell the name, you can just go to darkdiscussions.com, and on the right of the page there's a link directly to her website, which has her email, or you can email darkdiscussions@aol.com. or find Chrissy on the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group or on Facebook itself. And I'm sure you'll be able to get that signed for them, which will be cool. All right, so I think we can get into our topic tonight. I think that's it. So, yes, Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
All right, tonight we're going to be talking about the movie from 2011 starring Tilda Swinton called We Need to Talk About Kevin.
Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way.
Just because you're used to something doesn't mean you like it. You're used to me.
Wake up and watch TV. Get in your car and listen to the radio. And you go to your little job or your little school, but you're not going to hear about that on the 6 o'clock news.
You know where you're spending the afterlife.
I'm going straight to hell.
Because nothing is really happening. And it got so bad that half the time the people on TV, they're watching TV. And what are all these people watching? People like me.
Doesn't Kevin go to Gladstone High?
That's right. We Need to Talk About Kevin, 2011 film directed by Lynn Ramsey. She is, I don't know, I don't think I've ever seen any of her other films, but she has a number of films that have been nominated through, I guess, the circuit, the festival circuit. But prior to We Need to Talk About Kevin, she's mostly done shorts. She has a couple other full-length features, but this film was the big film that put her on the board. Screenplay is co-written by her as well as Rory Stewart Kinnear, and it is based off of the New York Times best-selling novel We Need to Talk About Kevin, written by Lionel Shriver, a 2003 novel, which I actually have read twice. So there could be some in the book.
No.
But either way,
knock
yes,
that shit off.
Either way, you were right. It does star Tilda Swinton, but also John C. Reilly and Ezra Miller and Ashley Gersiminovich. Those are the four leads, or basically the family that the movie revolves around. The film received decent reviews, about 60-something percent, 68% or so. Oh, actually, it's up to now 76% on Rotten Tomatoes, because I remember when it first came out, there was a bit of confusion, and it has grown to 76% now. The Roger Ebert himself gave it 4 out of 4 stars. So I guess that's all I got.
Is it that old that he was alive still then?
He sure was, yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Roger Ebert pretty much went all the way until he really became sick, bedridden. He died in 2013. So it was 2 years.
I thought he had died before we were podcasting. All right.
Yeah, no, he was.
Just been podcasting for that long.
He actually, I emailed him once way back in the 90s or early 2000s, and he responded. He was
nice.
A good guy. Yeah, yeah.
That's a restraining order, Phil. It's not a response.
I should have printed out the email too. I didn't, but back in those days, it didn't matter, or I didn't think it mattered. But yes, that's restraining order. All right. So,
and did it say who the hell is Sansa?
Sansa did not exist. Well, actually, she did exist, but only in print form at that time.
Yes, yes.
All right, so let's see. I guess we can go around how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. So, Mike, let's start with you.
It's been a long, long time. So I remember, I know this came out when we were first podcasting, and we had heard about it. And it got a lot of good reviews, and I got the Blu-ray for it. I watched it. I made my wife watch it. As teachers, it had a one particular impact on us. But it's a disturbing film. It's not a film I enjoy watching. It's not a film I thought I would ever watch again, because once we got out of like the release window, I figured we were never going to end up reviewing it. So it's hard. I don't want to say I enjoy the film, because I don't. But I thought it was a well-crafted film. I think Tilda Swinton gives a great performance. And I think it has some interesting questions. I think it toys around with some ideas of, when we get these people, these sociopaths that do horrible, horrible things, we always want to ask why. And I don't think this gives any answers. I don't think it pretends to give any answers. But it is, at the very least, an interesting exercise. So I don't know. I'll have more to say about it, but
it's hard to talk about this movie without spoilers. So.
Yeah, you know what would help? If we had Kevin Letts.
Because his name's Kevin?
Because his name is Kevin.
Yes.
There you go.
That way it would be just so much easier to talk with Kevin about Kevin.
That's true.
About needing to talk about Kevin.
Yeah. All right, so is that your summation there, Mike?
Yeah, I suppose. I really, really never thought of it. I don't know what to say. I will say one thing. I thought in addition to Tilda Swinton's performance being great, I thought the performances of Ezra Miller and especially the younger kids in it
right,
were good. And it makes me really wonder what the hell is wrong with these Hollywood parents, because right. I just, you just assume maybe they don't quite know what they're actually doing. So you hope to God that's the case.
Right, right.
Doubt that any of the child actors know where the story actually went, since it wasn't in their part of the script.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, I've always had that question anyway about not just the parents in Hollywood, but Hollywood in general and children actors. But that's a story for another day. All right, sounds good, Mike. Very good. For me, I actually heard about the film just from the buzz. Tilda Swinton, obviously, as well, because that was when she was coming off of her Academy Award and all that from Michael Clayton and so forth. And she had starred in the Witch, the Wardrobe, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie and stuff. So she was kind of big at the time. So she was always on my radar at that point. I was able to see like 10 minutes of the film at some weird preview that was online. And I was curious about it, the subject matter, like Mike said, sociopath, not serial killer, but spree killer type thing. A non-supernatural or science fiction horror or thriller always catches my eye. I obviously wanted to see it, but I couldn't because it was one of those weird movies like The Guest and a few others that released limited release and then never came out for another 8 months, and it kind of sucked. I do know that it was on our very first year of review episode because it came out in 2011 when the podcast started then, and we did our first review in 2012, January. And this movie popped up as one of the films that we discussed for a little bit. Yeah, so I actually read the book before I'd seen the film because I decided to read the book because I couldn't get to see the film. And then I read it a second time a couple of years later. The book is phenomenal, and the movie's really good. The movie does an excellent job taking the book and turning it into a feature film. I love this film and the book, not because it's fun or happy or anything like that, but because it's just a damn good film and a damn good book. High recommend by me. Chrissy.
I first heard about We Need to Talk About Kevin from you guys. I'd seen it bandied about the Facebook group, and it has always been on my list because of the positive things that I'd heard about it. I found this movie to be really complex. It definitely was not what I was expecting. I didn't see any trailers or read any reviews of it. I deliberately had saved it because I just want to experience it raw. But I also found it artful in a way that is extremely clear, in a way that makes sense. And in a film, when you're telling a story in what is tantamount to a nonlinear way, it's really important to make sure your audience doesn't get lost. And for me, this film did that expertly. I thought the acting was incredible. John C. Reilly is really one of my favorite actors. I've been an admirer of his since The Perfect Storm, which I think was actually the first movie I ever saw him in. And I really enjoyed him in this as the clueless father. The use of the color red in terms of what it means was a bit overused for me, but other than that...
I knew that was going to come up.
Yeah. Other than that, though, I really enjoyed just about everything in this movie. I love that it's got a very complicated message that's extremely relevant right now with what's going on in the world. I kind of want to stay spoiler-free right now. And I thought the ending was especially powerful. I just really like this movie. I think it's really well written and really well done.
All right. Very good. Eric.
I heard about this movie from Phil. He was talking about it a lot when it came out, and I decided to check it out. I can't remember if my initial viewing of this movie was prior to me owning the Blu-ray or not. But either way, I ended up owning the Blu-ray and I've watched the movie several times. I find this to be a fascinating character study. I think to piggyback on what Christy was just saying about giving answers, I don't think this film even tries to give answers. It just does a really good job of asking questions, which I find intriguing. And we'll get into that more post-spoiler flag. Yeah, what everybody said, excellent acting, great filmmaking here. It's not a fun story, but I think it's really solid telling. And due to that, I appreciate this film from a skill level immensely. I think it's weird to say that I enjoy this movie because of the some of the stuff that happens in it, but I do, and I just appreciate the hell out of it from a skill standpoint.
Yeah. Speaking of the book earlier, the book is the same way, Eric, where there's nothing answered at all. So it's interesting where there's a lot of things presented and really there's no answers. Lionel Shriver actually did a interview, a number of interviews, and she actually stated that it was intentional to have no answers, and she felt that she had broken a thing that had never been done in art, at least to her knowledge, which was parent hating a child. And as we see in almost every movie, everything has to be reinvented because there's not many new ideas, and she felt that her book may have been one of the first times that, or at least in recent memory, that happened, where a parent hates a child. I guess we can talk about anything we want before the spoiler, but it may be tough. But yeah, go on, Eric. You can
say I was just going to say, I think we need to throw the spoiler flag up pretty early on this one, but I think it's safe to say we can all recommend this movie for what it is, yes?
Yeah. Well, I love it. Yes, you obviously like it. And Chrissy certainly does. Mike is the one that was a little bit poo-pooing it, but not because it was bad, but because it was not entertaining.
I'm not poo-pooing it.
No, it's not. I'm not poo-pooing it. I'm saying it's a hard movie to say. Right. Look, this is not something like you say, hey, Ma, I got a good movie for you to watch. Or at least not my mom. This is a movie that will not appeal to large numbers of people because of the subject matter and because of the characters that are in it are arguably not sympathetic.
It's kind of art house, too. Right?
I think it's more likely to appeal to people who listen to this particular podcast.
The people who listen to this podcast would probably have an interest in it. I'm just saying it's like I said, it's a film I appreciate a lot. I can't say I watch it and go, yeah, I love this movie. And
no, I get it. It has an aspect of it that's it is a very
well made movie. Well, I don't know how personal it is to me, but it's a very, very well made movie. I don't want to give any idea that I'm holding back on that regard. I think it's a very impressive movie, but it's just a tough watch.
Well, it is, and that's what makes it genius. You know, this definitely is, I've said this before on this podcast, this is a thinking person's movie. This is a thinking person's movie that is really, really intense. You have to be in a certain frame of mind to really want to get into this. And some viewers are not going to want to get into this because it is so damn intense. It's almost one of those movies where when I was done watching it, I thought, oh my God, I need a palate cleanser. Like right now. Like I need to watch Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure just to get this out of my head. Like that's awesome. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
Not only that, Chrissy, but I think they do a good enough job of presenting this story that when I didn't know anything about this, I was thinking, is this based on something that actually happened? Because they do a good enough job of presenting the story that you might have that thought.
Yeah, and I think if I have a gripe about the film, that might be it, is that I don't think that it's actually based on someone real.
It is.
And so, because this is hitting on a very hot topic, and sadly just as hot a topic now as it was in 2003
when it was written. Yeah.
When it was written, yeah.
Even though it's not simplifying it, I'm wondering if it's giving people the wrong perspective of real school shooters as to who they are, what they are. I don't think it's necessarily saying that this is what they're like. It's a fictional
I don't either.
Story. It doesn't pretend to be anything else.
I think it asks an interesting question, though, which is... what about their families?
Right. And it also isn't really about the shooting. It's about, like Eric said, the families. The shooting is just a
culmination.
A thing that, yeah, exactly. Exactly. So that is an interesting way to look at it, though, Mike. The film and the book take place generally 45 minutes away from both Mike and Chrissy, because Mike would live west to it and Chrissy would live east.
Do they state where it is?
Well, in the book, they do. The city part is the meatpacking district in Manhattan. So when they're single, the mother and father when they're single. And then they move to Nyack, and that's the west side of the Tappan Zee Bridge, right off of 84. Which I was actually reading the book as we were driving through Nyack, as a matter of fact, heading down to Jersey. The shooting and the post shooting when she, meaning the Tilda Swinton character, is a travel agent, both that takes place in the general greater Nyack area, so right on the Hudson. So it's all New York. even though I think Lyle Shriver is from North Carolina. So
nobody cares, but, though.
Well, just give some background information of where it takes place. Okay, so that's all I got that. All right, so I guess we can discuss or put up the spoiler alert, right? You want to do that?
Yeah, let's do that. I'll do the wiki, and after the wiki, spoiler flag is up, all right?
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan.
All right. Wiki. Kevin's mother struggles to love her strange child despite the increasingly dangerous things he says and does as he grows up. But Kevin is just getting started, and his final act will be beyond anything anyone imagined.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think we have to talk about Kevin tonight, so let's start doing it.
All right. Spoiler flag up.
Yep, it's up. So basically, the movie is done in a disjointed way, as Chrissy mentioned. That's intentional because it's following the book fairly decently. The book is written in letter format, where she, meaning the mother, writes letters to her husband throughout the book. And so some of the letters take place in the future, the past, or the present. And, well, not the future, but like hopes, you know, things that I was hoping would happen. So the letters take place, when it is even better way to put it, is the past when they didn't have kids, the past when they did have kids, and then the present or the past after the incident that happens. And so the movie does that here too. So if you don't pay attention, you could get lost pretty easy in this, right?
Well, and yeah, I was noticing that because it had been several years since I'd watched the movie when we decided to do an episode on it. So I watched again. And I was interested in that aspect of, like, you really could like get very confused quite easily the way this is told in a nonlinear fashion. They do a good job of bringing it all together if you stick with it. But like for the first 20, 30 minutes of the movie, I can see how somebody on a first watch could get really confused.
Right, exactly. Because it switches scenes where they do like fade to white or fade to black to like scenes where... I mean, the opening scene alone is this weird scene where she's...
A tomato festival.
Yeah, tomato festival, I think in Spain. I think that's where it is.
Hey, what color are tomatoes?
Red.
Yeah. Tomatoes are red.
What?
I'm just making reference to Chrissy's calling out of the color red. It is used an awful lot.
Oh, holy shit. Yeah. It's actually, I mean... That opening scene, that opening image is very visceral, and the use of red is almost so overdone.
I think it was intentional.
I'm pretty sure it was intentional. The Tilda character, I forget her name, so I'm just going to call her Tilda for now.
Okay. There you go.
Is that what's
Eva Cachadorian.
Eva, okay, is almost Christ-like in that opening image, the way
right.
she's being mm-hmm. held up. And then we
like
hear...
Like Dany from Game of Thrones.
Yeah. And you hear the screaming, and you stole my baby, and murderer, and there's all this red everywhere. And it's difficult to tell at first if this is a dream or reality. Because then we see other red items come in right after that are much more subtle. Like we see the ketchup on the eggs. There's red wine. We see, which is also, by the way, connected to the blood of Christ in the churches where they say, drink the wine. This is the blood of Christ. The red candle. There's the visceral sound of the liquid dripping. There's red paint spattered on the windows of her front door and all over her car.
Did you say the tomato cans in the supermarket?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a list. I made a massive list.
I don't think we have to list everything.
Yeah, no. I do reference that, Mike. But, yeah, it's a little tough to figure out what's happening in the beginning, but this is a really – it's very surreal. But we also have elsewhere in the film, like you said, not listing everything, but there's little stuff like red chairs, red posters, red glasses on the secretary in the travel office where she goes to work. There's red folders on the secretary's desk. I mean, it's ridiculous how much red there is.
I do think.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I do think it's interesting that because red obviously is blood. You know, that goes without saying, but that could be an ominous sign, and it could also, but it also has a sign of vibrancy in life. And so you're seeing her in the beginning of the film and vibrant and full of life.
Yeah.
But that's also, but that's, and soaking in the red for that. But that also ties in, I think, and foreshadows Kevin, who at the end of the film is reveling in blood in a more literal way.
Well, no, and I absolutely agree, and I think as much as I said the red was overdone for me.
Oh, it definitely is.
What was cool about it though was that it was done so much in so many different ways that it not only ties into the Christ, like anybody can get all different kinds of messages out of it because of the way it was presented, which is really awesome. I mean, we have the Christ in imagery. It ties into the foreshadowing, like you mentioned. It ties into one or multiple themes in this movie. It ties into metaphor. I mean, in terms of the Christ imagery, she has sacrificed herself. She has given her very blood, if you will, literally through giving birth to bring this child into the world, who ultimately becomes a monster, right? But she is also a Lady Macbeth of sorts because she can never wash the blood of the children her son killed off of her hands.
Well, and I sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go ahead.
That's okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'd like to explore that a little bit because I think it's probably the most interesting aspect of this character study to me, as far as that character goes, is that, basically what we see is that this is the basic story here that we're being told, is that she had a boy named Kevin, and she never really liked her own son. And he grows up to do horrible things and ends up killing a bunch of people. And I guess one of the questions this movie asks is, did she hate him because he's evil, or is he evil because she hated him? And I think it's interesting that after everything culminates in the big event of him killing a bunch of his fellow students at school, she decides, and I'm pretty sure it's an intentional decision, that she's just going to take all the shit anybody wants to feed her because of this. She takes responsibility, and I mean, she could have moved away. She chooses not to move away. She stays in the town where this all happened, and she's accosted constantly by people who are affected by the actions of her son, and she never gets mad at anybody for doing it. Other people get mad at the way she's treated, and she's like, no, it's my fault. And I found that aspect of everything to be really, really fascinating, that she's just like, yes, this is on me. I will take every bit of abuse and shit that everybody wants to throw at me because it's my fault.
And she even gets the one encounter with a character who was a victim who doesn't hold her responsible. That's concerning for her.
And that was heartbreaking. She doesn't even know what to do.
Right. And you can understand it because she's blaming herself, rightly or wrongly. She blames herself, and he doesn't. So, yeah, it's.
He's like, "Hey, Mrs. Cacciadorian, how's it going?" She's like, okay. How are you?" And she doesn't even know how to act.
Doctor says I might walk again. Yeah.
She goes, "You look good." I'm like,
I just thought the her character making the decision to take all of it was really fascinating.
Well, and here is what is also so interesting about this. You know, as I said, just to finish up the Lady Macbeth thing, there are specific references to her, like, visual references to her, like, trying to wash the red paint off her hands several times, trying in vain to scrub it with a brush off her porch, and it doesn't work. But one of the other things that's really interesting, Eric, is, as far as being a character study, one of the books that I kind of looked into and read was called A Mother's Reckoning, Living in the Aftermath of Tragedy. Mm. And it's written by Sue Klebold, who is the mother of Dylan Klebold, who was one of the shooters in Columbine.
Mm, okay.
And when you read this book is probably one of the most heartbreaking books I have ever read. And this character in this movie very much reminded me of Mrs. Klebold and how she talks about society automatically looks to blame the parents and how this is not necessarily a new thing. Like how, like in the 1900s, if children were born with deformities, it was because their mother had, you know, sexual longings that were inappropriate.
Just little things like, you know, she saw a snake, and so you get a birthmark in the shape of a snake. They're just all
right,
stupid.
Exactly, yeah.
Stupid shit.
You know, in the 20th century, you know, it was homosexuality was said to be caused by overbearing mothers and passive fathers. Schizophrenia was blamed on how, you know, kids were raised. And she talks a lot about that phenomenon in this book, but also talks about the self-torture in, like, what did I do? What did I do? And I think just like Eric said, you know, in this, there is this question here of, was this child born evil, or was it the mother treating him that kind of turned him that way? And yet, I mean, there was a very fascinating article done on NPR. I don't even remember when it was published, but it talks about the amalgam of things psychologically. It talks about the amalgam of things that kind of go into psychologically making a school shooter, and how, as this has become sadly a more prevalent thing in our society, how they are starting to, just like tragic fires that kill people, right? You look at these big tragic fires in these hotels or these factories, okay? If you look across, like, say, 10 fires in the last 100 years, you see all the same hallmarks. You see either doors that are locked from the outside or exit signs that are not lit. You see usually a combination of combustible materials and or there are no fire safety things like sprinklers because they were cutting corners. You also see people not well educated in exits. And you also see failed building construction, meaning the building was built in such a way that it just went up like a freaking chimney. This article in NPR pointed out that just like in these fires, that the fire thing is my own assumption, but there are five or six hallmarks that these school shooters all have in common. There is usually a feeling of being rejected or being an outcast. And that outcast feeling, that feeling of rejection, becomes something to be angry about. It becomes something that to channel their rage into. That's one hallmark. Another common hallmark, and this is not true of every single school shooter. This was just something that this article was saying that is common in a lot of them. Extreme depression. One of the other hallmarks is the parental influence. How involved were the parents? And in some cases, that's the odd man out, because in some cases they came from very loving homes and they were very well supported and everything was quote fine and it was a loving normal family, And in other cases, they came from places of abuse or neglect. So it was just interesting to read all of this. And I think that's why this movie was so interesting to me, because having read all of this stuff, I was kind of like, wow, like somebody went balls on with this shit. Like somebody really examined all of this. And I wonder if the person who wrote this, like, read Sue Klebold's book, just because Mrs. Klebold does really talk a lot about her own guilt and how she had to deal with it. And like you said, Eric, in this movie where she just kind of lays down and takes the shit, you know, her family didn't, in the week following the Columbine, they didn't like go anywhere. They had friends hiding them in their garage because they were so afraid that there were people that were going to come and, like, you know, burn their house down and stuff. Very, very interesting stuff. So if there's anybody who's interested, any listeners that are interested in some of this psychology, there are resources out there. And I do highly recommend reading
them. I just bought
that
book while we were talking.
Yeah, it's an awesome book. And it's, you know what? It's so sad. I seriously think it's one of the saddest books I've ever read. This mother is so distraught about what her son did, and is like, I don't know what I did wrong. And like spends her, like, sat there in the hours after the disaster. She said, I went through everything in his freaking childhood, every little thing, like every time I said no to him, every time I denied him something, what did I do?
Well,
and so awful. It's heartbreaking.
According to what I'm looking at here, that actually wasn't published until 2016.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't think it was an influence
on
Well,
I can give you a story. Yeah, no. She didn't have used that. What she did was she didn't just use Columbine. She researched, meaning Lionel Shriver, the author, dozens of these shootings, and she actually lists them all in the book, because Kevin, like, he collects computer viruses. He also had collected and read stuff about these shooters, and he tried to compare himself, you know, as better than them, as usually they, you know, outdo the prior and whatever. So all that was invented by the writer herself. So,
well, and I thought one of the
I was just going to say, based off the 2016 release of the book that you read, Chrissy, it shows you how right on Lionel Shriver was, based off of your summation of Klebold's book. Eric, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I thought one of the genius things about this story is the fact that she made it a bow and arrow. That way this doesn't get mired down by the gun control argument that pops up around any type of this event of the school shooting. It's free of that, and it also ties into the part in the story where, like, the one bonding moment they ever had as mother and child was when she was reading him Robin Hood, and he got interested in archery, and the father got started getting him a bow and arrow as presents. So really, it ties the most horrific thing he ever did back to the one and only real bonding experience that they had. It's just like, whoa, yikes. Did he plan that, or just
Yeah, I got the sense that extra level of betrayal or what have you is very intentional. That's at least I did. That he goes out of his way to ruin anything, any connection he has with his mother. Mm-hmm. Any attempt she makes at a certain point. I mean, there are issues early on. And obviously when he's an infant. But there gets to be a point where she just can't win with him.
Right. And she's defiant his entire life. And there's like one brief scene when he's a teenager and she walks in on him masturbating. And instead of like being ashamed and stopping, he just locks eyes with her and starts going even faster. You're just like, oh God, that's awful.
So,
to get back to the bow and arrow. Yeah. Sorry to bring up the book, but, in the book, it's actually a crossbow, and it also, was easy to bring into school without being questioned because he didn't want to play sports, the regular sports, And so he petitioned to play, or I should say, do archery. And that's how, and so he created the archery team in the high school. And so he was able to be on campus with a crossbow because it was related to the sport. And so I thought that was kind of interesting in how deceptive he was. And unfortunately,
I went to school in New York 15 years before this book came out. Well, 20 years before the book came out, I guess. And I was on a rifle team. We were allowed to bring guns on the school bus.
Well, and we actually had archery as a phys ed section at my high school in Rochester. So,
right, so did I actually?
Yeah. So I don't think that was a necessary thing. See, I actually found the use of the bow, Eric, to be a little disingenuous because there's not a lot of school shootings that involve bows and arrows.
Well, and that's why
the whole point.
Because that's why the book's better, because the book uses a crossbow. And a crossbow is a much better weapon.
I just like the fact that it wasn't a gun. That was.
But it does depoliticize the issue.
Yeah.
I mean, you can politicize anything. It does depoliticize the issue compared to what it could be.
Right.
So
right.
Eric. I had never thought of it in that light, but that's always been something that kind of irked me. Is that if this was making an attempt to make a real comment about that, which I guess it's not. I don't know that it's trying to make a comment on school shootings. It's trying to make a comment on the school shooter.
Right.
No, I don't think the school shooting or how it's done is the point in this, but I would like to point out that while it does depoliticize the whole thing, there's two interesting things about the bow and arrow. What it does show, first of all, is that if someone is determined enough, then guns do not matter. They will find a way to harm people. They will find a way to do it. And I think that's a very fair assessment. The other thing that's interesting is that they chose, of course, the story of Robin Hood. I spent an extensive amount of time when I was studying medieval history in college, 28 years ago. Robin Hood really is an interesting character for this child, Kevin, to identify with, because who was Robin Hood? He was the champion of the downtrodden. Right. He was not only the champion of the downtrodden, the savior of the poor who were outcast, who were shit upon by the wealthy. He also was famous for doing it, became a legend for doing it. And what does Kevin say? Because obviously it's made pretty clear in this movie that Kevin does have some issues with delusion. Mm-hmm. Which is also, by the way, a thing that they say is kind of common in this school shooting type of thing, that some of them do suffer from delusions of grandeur, of being great, of not wanting to be forgotten by history. He does say to his mother that really chilling thing where he's like, well, you know, they come home and they watch TV and whatever it was, they do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And
you wouldn't be watching me if I was just good at geometry.
Right.
Right.
And what are they watching? They're watching us. They're watching people like me. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's.
Yes. Exactly. And that was very disturbing because of the way it was delivered too. You know, it's just delivered in this, you know, they wouldn't be watching, you know, you think they're going to watch you and your boring life? No, they're going to be looking at me. But then I also noticed, and I don't know if you guys noticed this, his father was clueless, but also he treated his dad completely differently than he treated his mom.
Oh, he's manipulating his father the whole time. He's gaslighting his mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I got to wonder if in his final moments, the father had the thought run across his mind, oh, shit, she was right the whole time.
So... Yeah, and that's a part of it. I think if I can go back to the thing with the mother, I don't think school shooters are a bigger thing because of the media it gets. So one of the things that I've learned is that it's like the one consistency is their obsession with other school shooters.
Mm-hmm.
Or similar, you know, a nightclub shooter or whomever. They all want to get the high score. And that's why you'll see certain media outlets now will never name the mm-hmm. person who does it because they're trying to avoid right. giving more people attention.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it won't matter because the names will be public record. There will always be one network out there that will at least be willing to name the names. And, you know, as somebody, you know, I don't think anyone here wants to say that there should be a ban on covering school shootings or covering mass shootings, whatever it may be. So I don't know that there's an easy answer to that. But that's really where a big part of it. But one of the things I think we always miss, and you have to remind yourself, is everyone focuses on just the dead bodies, right? And it's, you know, we saw the kid in the wheelchair in the film. Mm-hmm. You know, there are always the people who are dead, but there's always the other victims, which are the wounded. They're the victims that are the families,
yeah.
the witnesses, and people. And I've always said this: people forget about the families. And while I understand nobody wants to have any, or very few people have any sympathy for the killers themselves, these are also people who wasted their life. You know, who you know, like all of us started out as something with potential, and just something went horribly wrong. And we always want to know why, right? We all started mm-hmm. out basically the same, sitting in a, you know, in a 1x2 bin in a hospital room somewhere, you know, surrounded by other identical things that they have to label us right away because if there's an emergency, we all get shuffled up. Nobody can tell who is who anymore. And yet some of us grow up to be horrible, horrible people,
mm-hmm.
like podcasters. And you know, and that is a tragedy in its own light. I'm not saying that they don't deserve what ends up coming to them. They shouldn't be punished. They shouldn't be like. I'm saying that it's a loss that we should.
It's too bad they ended up in that place.
Right. And but nobody has sympathy. It's hard, and I understand it. If your child dies, it's hard to have sympathy for the mother whose son murdered your child.
Yeah.
And you never know, but everyone, there's always, you spend 2 minutes at the local diner or at a bar after something like this, and someone will always know, I know why, vaccines, I don't know what it is, there'll be always something, everyone will know, they'll know why, and sometimes it's, or they'll just say, no, they're just rotten, they're born that way, there's always, life is complicated.
Well, and that's one of my favorite aspects of this movie is the way the movie closes out at the end is he's in prison and she's visiting him as he's about to turn 18 and go from juvie prison to big scary prison. And she asks her son straight up, tell me why. And his answer is, I used to think there was a reason. Now I'm not so sure.
Well, I was just discussing this literally before this episode. I was discussing this with a friend of mine, and he was saying, well, the reason that we always want to know why in these situations is because if we have a why, or if we have something that we can accept as a why, then we think as a society or as individuals that we actually have hope of maybe figuring out how to right. control this or fix right. it. And he's absolutely fucking right. I mean, mm-hmm. I never thought of it that way, but I was like, holy shit. Yeah, you're right. And he's like, and the reality is
the scarier thing is that there's no reason.
There is no reason. And you can't have control. You know, it's like people are going to do what they are going to do. It's like any disaster, like I was talking about with the fires, right? Or like, you know, listen, disasters don't just happen. Just like they say on that TV show, Seconds from Disaster. A disaster is a chain of events and circumstances and maybe even coincidences that sort of all fall together in this crazy mix that you could never hope to predict, that somehow results in this giant disaster that kills a bunch of people. And in a lot of ways, I think that the psychological makeup of the school shooter is the same. Who's to say? I mean, somebody could have come from a situation just like Kevin. Okay, like the little girl, the sister. Oh, mm-hmm. We're playing Christmas kidnapping. Holy shit, right? That was hilarious to me, actually.
Right.
But I don't ever see this child. She was living in exactly the same household. She was treated the same way. But why was she so different a person from Kevin?
Like,
what? Yeah, what combination of circumstances? Why is Kevin a total fuck? And she's basically just a dumbass. Now, true, she could grow up and snap and do it too, because I believe that anybody can if you're put under a certain amount of duress. But it doesn't seem like she's got that same.
No,
I mean,
she's just a normal.
Just
she's awful. She was just a normal little girl.
She was pretty.
He was obviously. Well, and that makes me wonder if it's more. Him than Eva, meaning Kevin, because even though Eva, you know, that's why that we have the flashback when she was in Spain and the tomato festival, and her flashbacks with her making love with her husband or being single, or not single, but being married without kids with her husband in the meatpacking district. And then when the husband wants to move out of New York, because New York isn't as nice of a place to bring up children, what some say, at least he says so, than a suburb, she's all bummed. And so yeah, okay, so she has...
Basically, she feels like he ruined her life by being born.
Right, but that being the case, still doesn't necessarily explain how he grew up to be a sociopath, except that he probably was from the moment he was in the womb, probably.
Well, and I want to take a moment to give a shout out to the child actors in this film, because they do such a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this one scene where Eva is just sitting on the floor with Kevin, and she's just rolling the ball at him, trying to get him to roll the ball back. And this little kid they got to play this part looks just so fucking pissed off the whole time. I don't know how they got him to do that, but it's amazing.
Yeah.
And even that, it's a case of, right, so she's trying to play ball with him. So for whatever issue she had, and we can, and I'll give me a second, I'll get back to that, but her face lights up when he responds to her.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when he sees that she's happy, that he threw the ball back, just shuts right down.
Right. Right.
And again, great performance by the actor. And, you know, my understanding of how child actors work at that age, almost all the credit for that has to go to the director, you know, because, you know, I've known directors said they're basically props. You just got to know how to handle them. They're not like, trained or anything at that age. But pregnancy and childbirth is a weird thing. Women are weird things when pregnancy and childbirth gets involved. And, you know, sometimes you have like postpartum depression and sometimes you don't. And it could be the same woman, you know, and for some reason she deals with it one time. She doesn't deal with it the other time.
And it's interesting because in this story, it's like we already mentioned, it's clear that Kevin is always trying to be a little angel for his father, but not for his mom. He tries to do whatever he can to upset her. But it starts so early that it almost can't be a conscious decision to begin with. For instance, when he's just a baby, she's going crazy all day because he's crying his head off nonstop.
Yeah, he's a colicky baby.
She finally gets him to stop crying, and the dad comes in and she's like, no, don't pick him up. And he picks him up and he doesn't even cry. And the dad's all just happy and the mom's like, you think I'm making it up? And it's just interesting that whole dynamic started before it could have even possibly been a conscious decision on Kevin's part.
Right.
Well, and that's the reason why I said the colicky, Mike, was because there's the scene where in the meatpacking district where she walking the baby in a stroller, and he's just crying and crying and crying. So she goes towards a jackhammer.
And she finds the jackhammer almost more relaxing.
Yeah, because it drowns out the baby. It's and, a noise.
I think it was when we reviewed Mom and Dad last year, you know, that we talked about this, the idea that parents have thoughts that they're not allowed to say.
Right.
About having kids. And I say this with only 25% of the people on this podcast having children that I know of. I don't know what deep, dark secrets Eric and Christy have. So, and I'm not saying Phil wants to murder his children, but I know that there are times.
I'm sure there are moments.
That there are times when your daughter tries to manipulate you with a glass of water so she doesn't have to go to bed.
Exactly.
That you would want to do. You don't. What she did, like where she grabs Kevin and throws him against the wall. I know. There were times when I was growing up that I was a massive shit and I pushed my mother to the brink. And I don't know how she never broke. It's an amazing, you know, and, oh, this could be our Mother's Day episode. I'm just realizing that.
Go ahead, Mike. I just wanted to mention something.
I'm just saying, so I don't think that anything that we saw with her is all that unusual necessarily.
No, correct.
And I don't know how old Kevin was in the crying scene because he's in a carriage the whole time. I don't think we got a shot of him, but babies know how to manipulate the people around them. I mean, not in an intellectual way, but they make connections of things. So even then it becomes hard to figure out, like, again, how much was he doing just to bug the shit out of his mom? You know, how much was just colleague? There has to be something with Kevin to begin with that, no matter how bad mom is, necessarily to him, that he responds in the way he does. And that's why it's a complicated system.
We didn't talk about him.
And it's a complicated feedback loop. And she's tried to talk to him. That's the thing. She's tried to talk. And the father won't listen because he's manipulating the father.
Right.
And manipulating the father
the whole story.
At a very early age. And, there are stories. There are, you have to go through these child abuse things when in education, and it's where you have a mother with, four lovely children that she dotes on, and once she locks in the closet, it never lets out. and it's just by the time she gets the Celia, is the name of the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
By the time she has Celia, she's in a different place. She's been living in upstate New York now for, 7 or 8 years.
Nyack.
And so she's not necessarily so blaming, right? Whereas before she could blame Kevin on ruining her life.
Yep.
If you want to go there, by getting her out of the apartment in New York City. now she just has something that is a relief that's not Kevin.
I also enjoy that
could also explain the difference in the relationship.
Go ahead, Erica, and I did want to say something about this.
I was just going to say I enjoyed the fact that Kevin figured out that his mom was pregnant before the father did. I found that amusing.
Well, and she wasn't like
slightly pregnant. And he's just like, mom is just getting fat. And then the dad's like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah. What I wanted to say is just a couple things here. The first thing is we see the parents have sex and we get the sense that the creation of Kevin was really impulsive.
Yeah.
Because they do have a brief argument there about it being not safe. And he asks her if she's sure about this. And she says she's sure. And so I really feel that that was an impulsive thing. Now, there have been studies that have shown that children can be unhappy. Children somehow know if they were maybe not wanted or maybe they were an accident, that they somehow have this sense. So that kind of plays into this. But what's also interesting is that I have kind of a little brief personal story I'll tell you guys about this. My mother was pregnant with my younger brother, and she, most of the kids in my family basically were not planned, okay? Except I was. I was definitely planned. I was definitely wanted. Chuck was kind of came along when she really wasn't that interested because, honestly, her sister was dying of cancer. And my mother was very close to her sister. So when Chuck was born, she, and I remember this, I was 3 or 4 years old, she would just, okay, when Kevin was screaming and wouldn't shut up, that was my brother Chuck. It was all day long. All day long, all night long, all this motherfucker did was constantly scream, to the point where I remember sticking cotton balls in my ears and like trying to sleep downstairs in a closet because I could not stand his screaming. But my mother would not pick him up. She didn't want to hold him. She didn't want to do anything. She wanted nothing to do with him because she was grieving the death of her sister and did not. Now, to this day, Chuck is not a psycho. He didn't shoot up a school. He's not going to do anything like that. But my God, Chuck is an angry guy. Like, I think he knows that mom, like, did not really give him the attention that he needed. And that kind of follows with these studies that I've been reading a few years back about how children have this sixth sense and they just sort of know. And that was just my two cents that I just kind of wanted to throw in there. Because when I saw this woman trying to console this baby, I was like, oh my God, it's my fucking little brother. Oh man, like I've been here before. Like, you know, my mother would just put him down and walk away. She'd just walk away. Sometimes she'd just put him in a room and close the door and leave. And that's why, Eric, when you were talking about this movie, begging the question, did Eric, you know, did Kevin, like, was he born this way? I mean, mm-hmm. It's just like I said, it's a set of circumstances. That's the only reason I brought up that story about my brother. Because okay. I'm convinced to this day that he's aware something in his subconscious someplace, even though he doesn't remember it because he was a baby. And when I saw this movie, I wondered about Kevin and thought, I wonder if he knows. So that's why I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, it's interesting. And this whole movie is interesting around that facet of how much is he doing this on purpose and how much is this just the way he is.
Well, and I do have to wonder, too, because some of the stuff, like, he's still in diapers when he's, like, 8 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are some things there that are clearly, like, I don't know if he's really doing this to be a pain in the ass or if he's just doing it because there's some kind of malfunction there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, although he was pretty deliberate about when he could poop and
yeah,
when he
right.
didn't want to, so maybe he was doing that just to be a jerk.
Well, and that's
sorry, Mike, I didn't mean to.
I was going to say, right. So first of all, you have that. I do love that scene, right? Because she's asking him basic math questions, and he's getting them wrong.
Well, like, he's not though.
Well, wait. It's well, or whatever. He's not giving her the answer right. What number? What comes after 771? Which, yes, I know comes after 71. And then he counts to like 50 just to show her, I know what the fucking answer is. I'm not giving you anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then he shits himself. which makes me wonder, again, back to the mom who lets her child in this role. What is this 7 or 8 year old or 10 year old kid thing? You know, like, tells, I'm in a movie. Yeah, what are you playing? A kid in diapers. Mm-hmm. It's just, I wonder how they sold that one to the kid. Because, no, you know, if you're 7 or 8, you don't want to be thought of as a baby.
I also found it interesting that after she loses it and breaks his arm, when they come home from the hospital, he totally covers for her.
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is better because the book shows that he really uses it as a blackmail.
Okay.
So anytime she gets pissed at him in front of the father, she goes, Dad, and then she says, oh, I'm sorry, Kevin, let me get you the food, or let me get you that glass of water you're asking for. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he covers for her in the movie, but...
Back to the glass of water, somebody got traumatized tonight.
Yeah, but It's really more of a scam to be a dink, not because it's a blackmail thing, not because he's trying to cover up for his mother.
Well,
he didn't show enough of it.
Weirdly, in the film, he has there are two moments of connection with mom, and weirdly, one of them is when she breaks his arm.
Right,
because that's when he gives her a little respect. He doesn't narc on her.
Again, it's for black.
I know that, but I'm not. But then he also starts using the toilet after that.
Yeah, that's true. Also, there's another moment too that you're forgetting, Mike, which is the moment when she sees him looking at her book in the window. Because for folks who don't know, she's a successful travel author. Basically, she writes travel books, and she's been very successful. And that's her job. So obviously after Kevin does the murders, her career is ruined because no one's going to buy her book. She's dropped and all that. But there's a scene where Kevin is on the street looking at the bookstore, looking at her display, and the little daughter goes, "Oh, look, mommy, there's Kevin. He's little," you know, and as she's all like smiles when she sees it, and then he denies it all later.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was interesting too.
But I don't know exactly what he's thinking when he sees her in there, so I don't know.
Yeah,
connection.
Right. Well, in her eyes, it was a connection because she thought he was looking at, and was admiring his mother, because you know. But in reality, you're right. It could be anything. He could be
right,
looking
because
at pictures saying that motherfucker. I hate her.
Right, and there's been other times in the film where she was kind of hoping there was going to be something, and he shits on it. And of course, the other time is the whole thing when he gets sick. And I guess it's the only time in the film he actually gets legitimately ill. I mean, and there are kids like that that just go through childhood without getting sick. And that's where the whole Robin Hood thing comes in. And then he immediately, once he's better, goes back to treating. And and the interesting thing is, not only does he treat her well, he treats dad Papa like shit.
Right. Yeah.
But then as soon as he's better, he uses the Robin Hood thing against mom.
Right, and
by being outside and playing with dad with the archery,
yeah.
And you see him because he's got the little suction cup arrows, and you see him shooting at the target and missing the target, and dad encouraging him, and then he turns around and plants an arrow right in the window where mom's looking, right between her eyes,
right,
you
with
know,
the suction cup,
right with the right with so it's so. You do have a couple of times where there's connection, but it's always kind of turned around. It's always kind of perverse and perverted. And again, to me, that's, you know, fundamentally.
But you know what? I don't think it even matters because he's a typical sociopath because he kills a guinea pig. He blinds the daughter, the sister, one
eye.
Well,
here's the thing, though, Phil, and maybe and this is the one and only time I'm going to ask you about the book, which is that in the movie they are intentionally vague about whether or not it is actually him with the it was pretty clear the guinea pig's him, but the drain cleaner, it's totally, they don't show us that for sure. Do they state that clearly in the book?
No, it's similar to the movie because, like, for example, when he eats the lychee, I think that's how you pronounce that fruit.
Mm-hmm.
That's intentional to piss her off, meaning I did it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
and because it looks like he's eating an eyeball.
Exactly. And so he admits there's a lot more of those type of things in the book. So and you pretty much know that he did it intentionally, even if it's not.
I was just wondering because I noticed on my rewatch that you see her take the child lock off the cabinet to get the drain cleaner, but they never show her put it back. So there's a little bit of ambiguity there.
Right. Yeah. But she does say she put it back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Usually in a film, because time is of the essence, they don't have characters say things that are untrue unless,
right,
you know, it's very obvious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Unless it's obviously they're lying or that's going to be revealed as a lie later. And from the way that Kevin behaves, and has behaved up to that point, I think we don't have any reason to doubt that she's being truthful there.
I mean, the scene alone.
And it wasn't
alone,
like that minute. I mean, but yeah.
Right. I mean, the scene alone, when he says, hey, weirdo, do you want to come out and chase arrows for me?
And she's just like, no!
But, yeah, because she knows what, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of little things like that throughout the movie as well as the book that you know that.
Well,
that
and there was this really interesting dynamic between the father and her. Because, like, when she does that, when he says, hey, silly, want to come fetch arrows? And she says, no! He, like, gets up and walks out of the room in disgust.
Well,
because he's so upset about her blaming everything on Kevin, even though it is Kevin.
Right, and that's when the divorce or separation begins.
Uh-huh.
And that's when Kevin decides, okay, now it's time to do what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. So he, if you notice, he decides to do it after he finds out the parents are splitting.
Right.
Right, and I don't know that. I'm curious about, like, why would he do it? Well, actually, I take it back, because I don't know if that he does it because that's when it happens, but because I think they make it clear in the film, right? Because she says, oh, you're going to be 16 in 3 days. We have to do something to celebrate, you know, that he's doing it deliberately so he can do it before his 16th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
For legal purposes, so he could get tried as a minor.
That's a great point, Mike. She actually mentions that later in prison,
Actually, you would be tried as a minor at 16 or 17 as well.
It depends. You can be tried. You know, there are rules that allow somebody to be tried as an adult when they're below 18. I don't know the legal reasons in New York.
Well, the main thing I got out of it, as well as what I remember from the book, is that when the father bails, there is no more manipulation between him.
Right, he can't play them against each other.
Exactly,
anymore.
And he never loved the father. He doesn't love anybody, to be honest. The closest person that he loves is probably his mother, and it's because he likes ruining her
mother.
Yeah, so he never really loved his sister or his father, and so when they split, he can fake. He doesn't have to fake anymore that he loves the father anymore, and so that's when he decides to do what he does.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what I got out of it. But you may have a good point, Mike. It could be the age thing too.
Well, I love that. Like, as soon as he gets, as soon as he sees the baby for the first time, he immediately starts flicking water in her face. Right?
Oh yeah.
I mean, and look, that doesn't mean he's a sociopath. It just means he's a shitty brother. Like, you know, pretty much all of them. Mm-hmm.
Right. But we know he's a sociopath because of all the other things that happen throughout the movie.
Right.
The one thing that's interesting about this is that the mother loses two people as well. So it's I don't know if I can believe it as much that all these people would be mean to her.
Oh, I can.
Public, because she lost two people.
Because why, Phil? Well. Why can I believe that?
Because people suck.
Yes.
Yeah, also,
Kevin is his hero.
This is similar to the one that happened a couple of miles from you, Chrissy, because the mother was murdered in that one, and here we have the kid kill his family too before he goes off and does what he does, and this is different than most of them, because most of them, you know, you don't hear about that. They just go
and I thought what was particularly effective in the way it was presented in the movie is that, well, there's a few things I want to hit on. One is that we were talking earlier, I wanted to circle back to this, but we got past it. We're talking about delusions of grandeur. Whenever they cut to, they do a very tasteful job of making it very clear that horrible, horrible things happened at the high school without showing a whole lot of it.
Yes.
So, and in a lot of the scenes where the cops are at the high school and everything is getting exposed there, where you hear the sound of a cheering crowd. When they show Kevin, because that's how he's thinking of himself at that moment.
Right.
So I thought that was interesting.
The whole film is from Mom's perspective, just like the book is from the letters. So I think you see her imagining moments.
No.
There's shots of him when she's not around.
What happens is...
Not a lot, though.
No, because the book is all through her perspective. However, what we see of the kid doing what he's doing is from two things. One, from at least in the book, it's from news report articles that she's quoting, as well as her own discussion with her son. And what it turns out to be, at least in the book, is that he targets people that she knows or are well-loved in the town. So, you know, students that are popular.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And so students and teachers that are popular, and he gets them to come to the gym by some you know, things going to happen. We need you at the gym. And they all show up there.
In the movie, they almost imply that it was like a rally or something, because you hear the cheerleaders.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Like, a couple of them are cheerleaders. A couple of them are the football people. A couple of them are the team captain of the debate team. You know, people that are somewhat noted, and he takes them all out. And then that makes it even more interesting, because it shows more like he's also jealous of certain people or whatever. And in the movie, obviously, you know, they can't develop all these minor side characters like they can in the book. And some of them, of course, are friends of, you know, the mother's best friend's kids, you know, things like that, too. So it makes it even worse in the book. So, and of course, when you have a crossbow, it's much easier to take out everybody versus, you know, a bow and arrow. So it's just insane in the book.
To get back to where I was going originally.
Actually, bow and arrow, I could probably fire faster.
So to get back to where I was going originally with this was that I thought it was very effective the way they presented it in the book, where she went to the high school and saw everything that happened there and then comes home after that horrible experience to then find her husband and daughter murdered by her own son.
Right,
And that's why I thought that was particularly horrific.
And that's why we keep on hearing the sprinkler throughout the movie.
Right,
It comes back to that scene where she hears the sprinkler and she goes out. And the thing is when she goes out and she finds them dead, she doesn't freak out or anything because she expected it. It's like, this is Kevin. He did it, and she just looks and just walks away like in melancholy rather than in mass hysteria. And it's because she's shell-shocked because that's Kevin. And, you know, it's not like if she had come home first and found them dead, I think she would have freaked.
Well, yeah, and there's also the fact that when she went to the high school, she went there thinking, oh, God, is Kevin all right? Is Kevin all right? Is Kevin all right? And then got there to discover, oh, shit, Kevin did this.
Right.
So, yeah, she was in shock for sure.
And you do see her come, but you also see when she discovers the bodies. When she comes out, she's comes back into the house, she's covered in blood. So she clearly went and must have grabbed them, hugged them, done something with them. So we just, I just don't think we saw her reaction.
Right. Well, and she's soaked too, right? Because she went through the sprinklers, obviously, to the bodies. So that makes another good point that she probably went to the bodies as well, Mike. Yeah.
Yeah,
so basically Kevin takes away everything from her, because even though she didn't like the suburbs in a sense, because she
they had made a life there.
Yeah, exactly. Her best time was married and with no kids, and you know, in the age of 20 something, you know, living it up in New York with her husband. But at that point, like you said, yeah, she made a life there. She has friends there. She has a good job. Her husband has a good job. And whatnot, and then everything's destroyed in a matter of a half a day. Because of this scumbag. In the movie you don't really get it. The husband is a insurance photographer, so he goes out and does all the photography for insurance companies. Yeah, so that's what his job is. And he's, like, higher up, too, so he's got good money as well. And then she makes huge money, too, because of the books.
Well, it's clear they're well off.
Oh, yeah, the house is a mansion.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, and I did actually have a question, because one of the descriptions, as I said, I avoided everything before I saw the movie. But one of the descriptions I did see referenced something to the effect of, a woman gives up her life as a successful whatever, some fabulous career, to have this kid and then later turns into a horrific thing. But you know what? I didn't know what she did for a living. I didn't get that from the movie at all. I didn't realize. I was wondering, like, they kind of subtly reference it, like, when she's looking at all her postcards, and but they never really, like, even when she goes to apply for that new job, the woman just says, oh, you've done everything. Like, I never got the sense that she sacrificed this fabulous career.
Well,
until I saw the book in the window, and then I was like, oh, wait, okay, you know?
Is that the book explains it better, because obviously the career is sacrificed for a couple of years, but it's not complete. I mean, as you can see in the movie, which it didn't explain, was obviously when Kevin's born, she has to stop doing certain things for a while. At least that's her choice. And then after he gets older, she's back doing the same thing, because you remember she had all the posters of the world maps on the wall, because she
In the movie, my experience was it didn't really matter what her career was. The important point was she used to be able to travel and loved it, and had that taken away when Kevin was born.
Right, which is true, but obviously in the book you can see it a little better, because after he becomes a certain age, she starts doing it again. And as you saw when he's in high school in the movie, she has a brand new book out of her, you know, of one of her, you know, travel guides. So it is, but you're right. It's really secondary to the main plot. Her career really wasn't that important, except for the traveling part, because it was fun. And so we never really understood what she did for a living in the movie, because they obviously didn't go in that much detail. We just know that she sold some sort of book, mm-hmm. and that she did something to do with traveling, but we weren't really sure.
Well, and like I said, it wasn't a plot point that, like, bothered me, you know, because you guys know me well enough that sometimes, oh, justification, you know, blah, blah, doesn't bother me or whatever, you know, bothers me. But I'm fine with that. I was just a little bit confused because one of the film descriptions I read specifically brought it up. So I was almost actually looking for that. And so when I didn't see it, I was like, you know, I wouldn't have known this if I hadn't read the description. But that kind of affected what I thought about her in terms of, oh, she gave something up. Do you know what I mean? Like,
that
kind of played into my opinion of it. So if I hadn't known that going into it, I think I might have had a different opinion.
Well, you know what?
That's the reason I brought it up.
You're right. I mean, and technically she's right, meaning Eva's right. She did have to give up certain things in her life. But, I mean, we all have to do that. I mean, especially after we make certain choices, you know. I mean, it's like the poor kid that gets pregnant at the age of 16, you know, they have to get married and they have to skip college. And, you know, their lives are completely different had they not had that mistake. And they have a child at the age of 30, you know, with probably different partners. So, you know, a lot of things you do that just happen that change your life, as well as things that you choose. You know, you choose a certain college degree. When you get out of college, you can't become a doctor if you didn't study to be a doctor. You studied to be an accountant. So, you know, you have to look more into that. So a lot of things you sacrifice and whatnot. So her complaining is somewhat legit, but also it's some of the things is like, you know what, it's just how life is. You got to suck it up, you know. I mean, it's
kids ruin everything.
Well, and it's not even the kids, it's like I mentioned, it's the degree. If you chose the wrong degree,
I choose to believe it's the kids.
Okay, that's fine, but I'm trying to be serious here, where anything can change your life. You know, you could say I'm going to move to Austin, Texas, and you go down there and it's like, damn, why didn't I move to Minneapolis or stay where I came from? Yeah, you know, it's you know, you make decisions and you just sometimes you have to stick with them. Sometimes you can change them. Obviously, if you have a kid, you can't. So, yeah, I mean, it's not the end of the world. You just got to adapt, you know, and based off of what happened, she does adapt. It's just that Kevin's a dink.
He's a little more than a dink.
Well, Right. Because, I mean, she really does adapt. I mean, like Mike said, you know, when she has the second kid, everything's fine. She tries to, when the kid grabs the ball, she smiles because, oh, it's working. And then, but, mm-hmm. you know, so she is adapting, even if it's not the you know, everybody has that great moment in their life, like she did when she first got married and she was able to travel.
Yeah, and that's a valid point. I don't think she wanted to be a crappy mom. Right. She wanted to be a good mom, but she just got nothing back from Kevin, no matter how hard she tried.
Exactly. That's the reason why I can forgive her for being bummed about her life changing, because again, she's still willing to adapt. She was moved to Nyack. She took a few years to try to bring up Kevin good, you know, and so she adapted. So I don't think it's her fault at all. I mean, he was just a bad seed. He's the bad seed. Just like
right. Right. But I just find the whole presentation of the dynamic fascinating, because it's like, is it him? Is it her? Is it both? Is it neither? It's interesting.
And you're absolutely right, because you don't want to believe that he's just a bad seed. So you blame yourself a lot, and yet it's not really your fault, but you know, you still feel that way. And so it is a great dynamic, because it asks these questions, is like, was it something her, was it her being somewhat selfish when she was younger and he was first born, or was it something else and he's just a bad seed, you know? So I don't know, because the father was loving to the kid, so it wasn't like he lived in a shithole. It wasn't like
that's
the kid
true
was being
abused. That's true. Yeah.
So he's just a scumbag.
Yeah, pretty much,
you know. But you're right. I mean, that's what makes this, the novel and the movie, very interesting. It's like that ask that question, which is why, as Chrissy said, why did this happen? What is it? How can we get an answer so things like this don't happen?
Mm-hmm. Well, people have a hard time accepting there's no answers.
Right.
Going back earlier, you know, we said everyone thinks they know the answer. As stupid as people are, we are intelligent creatures, and intelligence is how we deal with the world. We may not understand it correctly, but we think we do.
And we have biases.
And we have biases and all that. But it goes back, even like, you know, we believe that if we can understand a thing, it gives us control over it. It doesn't necessarily, but we feel like we do. You know, think back, you know, the old days where they said, if you name a thing or I know the name of the thing, you have power over it. We don't, but we like to be able to label something because we feel comfortable. If we can put it in a box, or we can categorize it, we think we have, gives us some illusion of kind of control or understanding over the universe, even though we don't have it. We like easy answers, and the world doesn't give us those easy answers. Right. Kevin is just, look, you know, this is just a fundamental thing we don't like to say, like to realize. We like to believe in free will, and you know, nobody wants to say that necessarily that I am the way I am because of all the external influences of my life and so forth. But at the same time, we also don't like to think that we're powerless. As fundamentally, sometimes it is just comes down to who the person is when you're born. I know a lot of parents with a lot of shitty kids. Now, most of the time, we just had our society induction the other night, and in the past, I've had to give the speech at some of those, and I have said at one of my speeches, I said that when you look at, whether you're looking at the best kids or looking at the worst kids, usually if you look at the family, you understand why the kid is the way they are. And that's true, but there is, every now and then you get a great kid from a horrible family, or you get a horrible kid from a great family. You know, the average person, there's a lot of influence from your, obviously from most directly from your parents. You know, there's, but there's also a lot of influence from friends. There's always a lot of influence from your environment and all these other things. But there's just some people that will always thrive and some people that will always sink no matter what you do. And it sucks, the idea of being that powerless to stop it.
Yeah.
Well, I did want to mention some random thing. I know this has been a really fascinating conversation. But there were just a couple of things I wanted to mention that were just sort of random symbol things. First of all, I loved the whole thing about the broken eggs, where she's in the store, and even though she's just trying, well, just because she's like, I'll take them the way they are, because she just wants to get out of there. Mm-hmm. But what was fascinating about the broken eggs to me was that they were a symbol. It was like producing a broken child.
I didn't stop and think about that.
Which was kind of neat. And the other thing I really liked was that when she was giving birth, they were telling her to stop resisting, which I thought was interesting because it was almost like she really doesn't want to bring this kid into the world.
Right.
She really doesn't want it. She doesn't even want to push him out. That was very interesting to me. So those were just a couple of random things I wanted to mention just before I forgot them. But okay. Anyway.
Yeah, that's a curious one, the second one especially, because it could be interpreted numerous ways, but obviously the symbolic way is that she just doesn't want the kid to come out because she wants to be a child's mother still. But in the real world, if we saw that, we could think anything. We could think that the pain is so bad that that's why she's holding back. Who knows? But yeah, that for a novel or a movie, that most certainly would fit perfectly, Christian. That's a good point. How about the eggs too? They show a scene later in the movie where she's eating a scrambled eggs and she's pulling out like
right
pieces of the shell from her mouth because it's too much.
Personally, I probably would have done that before I scrambled them, but that's just me.
Well, and that kind of parallels like when you know we have the flash to Kevin in prison and he's biting his nails.
Mm-hmm.
Which was so gross and toe curling, man. The sound design in that scene was just—I was just sitting there going, "Oh God, oh God, stop biting your nails!" Oh God, it was like nails on a chalkboard. It was so well done. There were so many things in this movie that were
sound design's fantastic in this movie.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And the soundtrack too. I love the country and the folk music that mm-hmm. they use. Mm-hmm. And Buddy Holly and all that other stuff is pretty.
Well,
good.
And what's interesting,
but like you mentioned, the sprinkler. Is present throughout the whole movie, and then the non-associated sounds in the background while you get certain visuals. It's all very interesting.
Well, I like the cheers as he walks out of the gym.
Right.
You know, which slowly turns into the cries and the parents. Right. But that is, you know, putting you in his headspace for that moment.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Well, and it shows you the last scene just shows you how much of stupid kid he is, because a lot of these people do it for semi infamy and all that. You know, we hear that they do it for infamy. Some of them do it because they're just mentally ill. Some of them do it because they have a grudge, and some of them do it because they want to live in infamy along with those other issues that they have. And this kid here, he wants to do it, you know, for infamy or whatever the word is. And what happens is, he gets his interview on TV and all this other crap. His head shaved. He has no freedoms. It looks like he has a scar on his head as well. Never mind.
That does look like that.
Yeah. So,
and also from what you said, Phil, it sounds like he also intentionally tried to make it as bad as possible for his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in general, right? I mean,
mm-hmm.
He knew that she was going to, not only does he kill her daughter and her husband,
mm-hmm.
because even though they were separated and she didn't want the separation. But
from what you said, it sounds like he targets people at school intentionally to make her life as miserable as possible.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So yeah, like it says in the book. Yeah. So and that's the reason why, like the woman that, not the woman that punches her, the one that, and not the one that breaks the eggs, but, it may be the one that punched her. In the book, that was like her best friend, and so, you know, the whole friendship's gone, never mind the death mm-hmm. of the child.
Right, right.
So, yeah, absolutely. He was everything that he did was specifically against the mother. It had nothing to do with, I mean, and that's the thing that's weird, right? Because I just said he did it for infamy somewhat based off of that stupid interview that he does on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But again, a lot of it was not really even that. It was to just piss his mother off even more. And then
And as he says at the very end of the movie, he doesn't even think there's a reason.
Yeah, he doesn't even know why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which might be more frightening than actually having an answer.
Right. Another thing that's weird, too, is that she, in the book, she sets a bedroom up with the Robin Hood book and all that other stuff for when he comes out of jail. Even though he did what he did to her and her family, she's still going to willingly accept them back, which of course makes no sense. She's obviously damaged anyway by this point, because there's no way that he's going to ever get out of jail. I mean, it was a childhood murder, but I mean, it was a mass murder. So I don't know.
Don't ever underestimate the New York legal system.
That's what I was thinking. I knew you were going there, Mike. I knew you were going there.
I've watched too much Law and Order.
Yeah. So maybe he'll get out, even though he killed seven. No, I think it was like 13 people. So I can't remember. But
they also are very vague about that in the movie.
Yeah, they actually give them.
You know for a fact he killed sister and father.
Right.
You know he put that one dude in a wheelchair, and that's really I think all you know for sure.
Well, you kind of know that the one that punches him, that kid got killed. So that's four victims, three dead plus a wheelchair, and then the one that pokes all the eggs, that one you could say, but in the book you actually get the number and stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's like nine kids or something.
Yeah, something like that. So it, because it's not really necessary, you just know that he killed a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
And then that's where I go in my mind, because that's the way my mind works. How many people is he going to shoot before somebody tries to tackle him?
Yeah, right,
because it's not right. It is a bow and arrow, and you can fire a bow and arrow quickly. But
he's on the balcony in the book.
Okay,
and so
even if he's not, there's also just they've done studies on this and shown that human behavior in a situation where something bad is happening, our tendency is to assume that somebody else is going to do something about it. There's the famous study they did on a woman who got raped in the middle of a courtyard in sight of like 150 different windows. And they interviewed a bunch of people, and like almost everybody knew that something bad was happening and assumed that somebody else would call the police. And nobody actually did.
Right, it's a weird thing.
It could be that kind of situation where
everybody's trying
like,
to escape.
Somebody else is going to be the one that goes tackles that guy. It's not going to be me.
There was a book that came out a few years ago that looked at this. I think it was called How We Decide. And it is about how we pick up cues from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And so with nobody being there in the courtyard, nobody sees anybody helping. So no one goes to help. Once you see a person take that first step,
mm-hmm.
then others are more likely to also do that, but we are very much social animals.
Right.
Well,
so if everybody's running away from Kevin, it's less likely that somebody's going to try and tackle him.
Well, and that's a different situation. The rape, that's just people being...
I know it's different, but
no.
Understand the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I understand. But like, for example, something like this, when you hear a gun, everybody just starts running, right?
Right.
And in this case, you don't even hear bullets because all you hear is a thunk, thunk.
You sit there and think, a bow and arrow, and then you get killed by an arrow.
Right. Well, and another thing, too, is he only targeted a certain number of people, too. So it wasn't like it was just going to be hundreds of people where, like, the Las Vegas thing or mm-hmm. Columbine or Virginia Tech. This one here was he got the people he wanted into the gym, and he takes them all out, whether he kills them or he injures them. And then once that happens, that's when he comes out willingly from the gym. So it wasn't like
he had a goal
where the cops come in. And
he had a goal, and he accomplished his goal, and then he gave himself up.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. So do we want to put a bow on this thing?
Yeah, I guess we could. Sounds good. Before we give our final thoughts on the movie, I know a few people here had some things they saw and they wanted to let folks know about in their opinions. I did have a question for you, Mike, first. We'll start with you. So you saw the movie Shazam. How was that?
It was okay. It's one of the better DC films.
Right?
Yeah. It's a good one. It's weirdly dark in places, and there's some themes that I'm not sure are good for children, or not good. I don't mean those are going to corrupt their soul, but I think maybe hard for some kids to get their head around, or may lead to some difficult conversations with small children, which is just weird because otherwise it's kind of family friendly. And so, yeah, I enjoyed it. I mean, I've enjoyed it more than the other Captain Marvel movie, but it was fine.
Okay, very good. All right, so I guess we go around any news or things we've seen that are genre related that people were interested in discussing. Eric, you saw a film called Headhunter?
Yeah.
How was that? Some people have said it was pretty good, but so I'm not sure.
It's not for me. That's what I'll say.
Okay.
I didn't find it particularly enjoyable.
Okay.
I'm not saying nobody else should watch it. I'm just saying I didn't particularly enjoy it.
Gotcha. All right. Sounds good. Anything else that you wanted to bring up, Eric?
I can't remember if I talked about this on the podcast. If I did, cut me off, so I won't talk about it again. But I acquired a 4K version of Alien for the 40th anniversary. And I highly recommend it for anybody out there who's got a 4K setup. It's beautiful. And interestingly enough, I was texting Phil about this. The disc came with a digital code that you can enter for Movies Anywhere, which I did. And so then it showed up in my iTunes account. And apparently there are features in the digital version of the movie that are not on the disc, which is a little weird. Usually it's the other way around. But in the digital version that you get once you enter your code, there are actually 6 short films inspired by Alien available to watch. And they're for short films, they're pretty decent. And I recommend checking them out. So it's a high recommend for me to pick up the 40th anniversary 4K for Alien.
And it has both the director's cut and the theatrical release?
Yeah, it has both of those. It has every commentary that's been recorded. It's got over 3 hours of behind the scenes, which is awesome. Yeah, it's if you like this movie, this is a great copy to have.
Excellent. And it is one of my top 10 favorite horror films of all time.
Currently on sale on Amazon for $14.99.
The 4K?
Nice. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, that is a great deal. All right. Anything else, Eric?
I watched... hang on. Let me pull up my Letterboxd real quick, because I can't get this title right to save my life. I watched Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile, which is the Netflix movie that just came out about with Zac Efron playing Ted Bundy. And I had already watched the Bundy tapes on Netflix, so watching both was a little weird, and this one seems really, really compressed because it's just a single movie rather than a miniseries. But it was still quite good, and Zac Efron was excellent as Ted Bundy in it. But if you've already seen the Bundy tapes, it's a lot of the same information fictionalized, and feels like it's really glossed over and done very quickly if you've already seen the multi-part series.
All right, interesting. All right, so if you had watched this first without watching the multi-part actual documentary...
I think it's good, yeah. Okay. It's so good. It's just weird to watch in conjunction with the other one.
Gotcha. Right. Anything else, Eric?
That's it for me.
What about you, Mike? Anything else you wanted to bring up?
I'll mention... I think Eric did. I don't know if you mentioned it previously on the podcast, the third and sadly final season of the Santa Clarita Diet.
Oh, I binged that the weekend that it came out.
Yeah, so did I. And it was fun. It was sad that it ends. I can kind of see how it works as an ending, but it really...
Yeah, it's kind of a cliffhanger, but whatever.
It was probably a cliffhanger, right? Because it wasn't supposed to be the final season.
Yeah. Right. And I don't know if we've mentioned, I think we're on the podcast, I think maybe somebody's going to do an episode on it, is on Netflix, is the spinoff of this TV series Z Nation called Black Summer,
That's right.
which yeah, really
me and Mike are definitely going to do an episode. So I'm not sure if other people want to join in, but continue, Mike.
Yeah, it has very little to do with the TV series, as far as I know, and certainly not in tone, because that's apparently been more of a lighthearted zombie series. It was really solid. It's, was it 7-8 episodes, Phil?
It's 8 episodes.
It's 8 episodes. Most of them are under 50 minutes. The last one's less than 30 minutes. I was able to watch them all in probably 2 or 3 days on spring break. And I highly recommend. It's kind of like if you took the first 5 minutes of Dawn of the Dead and turned that into the remake of Dawn of the Dead and turned it into a TV series.
Right, or the Brad Pitt scene in the middle of New York City in World War Z.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just crazy action, chaos as the apocalypse happens, and it's really good. My wife and I watched it too, and she's not really into genre stuff, and she thought it was an awesome show as well. It's good stuff. Black Summer, which is available on Netflix, and season one, assuming it's just one season, could be more. But it's definitely worth checking out. It came out about 3 weeks ago, maybe 4 weeks ago, Mike, something like that.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, it's not too old.
But it might be my favorite. I mean, I'd have to go back and think. There hasn't been a lot of good horror stuff this year. It might be my favorite horror thing from 2019 so far that I've caught.
Yeah. It is pretty solid. I could probably agree with you there. Though I think my favorite horror scene of the whole year, just a scene, was the Umber kid on the wall. And
that was good.
That was good.
Solid
too. Yeah.
Oh, and I'm sorry, I did forget one more thing. And a certain someone who shall remain nameless posted a link on our Facebook page where you could stream all of the available Godzilla films. Amazon has a lot of them. Unfortunately, they're for rent. They're not part of Amazon Prime. If you happen to be a cable subscriber and have a smart TV or an Xbox or probably a PlayStation and subscribe to the Starz network, you can stream those for free. They've got a lot of the 60s and 70s films. In fact, while we were talking about what to do about Kevin, I had Invasion of the Astro Monster playing on in the background. So
yes, so you could probably do that through Comcast too, if you have Stars through Comcast, because the on demand,
right? And the new Criterion Channel, which is another streaming service. I don't know if they have a free trial period or not, but it's another one of those like $10 a month things. But those also have a lot of the Godzilla films. I'm not telling you to pay for it. I understand there's a lot of stuff out there, but I'm saying if you want to catch up, you know, if you want to relive the moments of
the
your childhood.
Because the plot is so essential to Godzilla movies.
Exactly. But if you want to just relive, you know, the Godzilla stuff from your childhood.
They're pretty solid. They're fun movies.
They're fun. They're fun. If that's a thing you like, if you want to watch those.
They look good on Blu-ray.
There's some places that you can watch.
Yeah. What was that?
Phil, film
that was terrible that you saw, Mike, just that came out by Neil Marshall a couple of weeks ago.
Hellboy, which I did see it. I didn't think it was that bad. I understand it was not the Del Toro films. If you were wanted more of the Del Toro films, you're going to be disappointed. I didn't think it was great, but I had fun with it.
Right. Anything else, Mike, before we move to Chrissy?
No. Nope.
Okay.
Chrissy, okay.
You have a big thing, which, believe it or not, Sean Fox, one of our listeners from Canada, found our podcast because of an episode we did about the same topic that of the show that you're going to talk about.
Yeah, the show, and I did post about this on the Facebook group earlier in the week, just because it was really cool to hear from so many listeners, people that found me on Facebook and messaged me and referenced the Chernobyl Diaries episode, which was, I believe, back in 2013? It was like a long time ago now. I was like, holy crap, it's been that long already. So it was really awesome to hear from so many listeners just asking questions or what did I think about it? Should I watch it? Do you think this is good? I wanted to give a shout out to listener Sean Fox, because he also reached out to me And we had a really nice discussion about it over Messenger. And I think we're going to kind of do like a little rehash just between the two of us every week after each episode. But it's on HBO. It's Chernobyl. It is a 5-part miniseries, and it runs on Monday evenings at 9 p.m. For the next 5 weeks. Episode 2 is coming up shortly.
What channel is this on?
It's HBO. On HBO.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh, by the way, our Chernobyl Diaries episode, which was episode 76 of Dark Discussions.
Holy shit.
October. October, yeah. October 19th, 2012.
Yikes.
Wow.
I remember doing that episode, and I remember the room I was in. I remember I was laying on the floor, my back, looking up at the ceiling as we were talking. So I remember, it's weird because it's like, it feels like yesterday, and yet it was 7 years ago.
I remember sitting in Buffalo Wild Wings with my notebook writing notes about the movie after I watched it in like a mostly empty theater.
Right. Yeah, it's just nuts how time flies. It's disgusting.
I know, it really is. It feels like it was just yesterday, because I remember
my two kids weren't born, my dog wasn't born. I mean, it's just freaking weird. A pickle wasn't existing yet.
I had two entirely different cats.
Yeah,
yeah. I didn't have Lilith and her kids. Yeah. Oh God.
Had just gotten married.
Yeah.
Literally, yep. Like less than a month before, I had just gotten married.
Yeah, we didn't know that. My
podcast room was my youngest daughter's bedroom, and now I'm in the basement. So it's just crazy.
But anyway. Some people have been asking me if this series is any good, and the answer, in my opinion, is, oh my God, yes, 1,000 times yes. The way the writer, who's a guy named Craig, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. It's either Mazin or Mazin, has structured this story. The choices he made, particularly to – and these are not spoilers, because these are things that we already know happened.
This is based on actual events. You can't
this really is not a spoiler. But he chose to open with Legasov's suicide. And the accident itself. We get the big bang in the first 5 minutes. And so it's almost structured. It's like the opposite of a disaster movie. And where you have all of this buildup and then you have what you're expecting to see. And he did this basically backwards. And the result is just brilliant. It just sucks you right in. It captures you. And it really makes you feel a sense of foreboding doing it that way. And I think this was real life horror. And this guy went out of his way to really present this real life horror to you. And in fact, I think they've toned down a lot of the horror of like the radiation sickness and what really happened. They did some pretty scary things that are really pretty terrifying in showing you that. But I do know from having read
good amount of barfing.
Yeah. And they're very subtle about that. You do see it. But it's worse than that. There is one scene, for those of you who are squeamish, where the guy gets very close to the core, because they tell him to go look at the core because they didn't believe the core was gone. And literally he's standing there and he just – his legs just start bleeding right through his suit, because mm-hmm. that's how intense the radiation was.
Is it bad that I want to see that?
No, it's awesome. It's awesome. The way that they recreate the reactor – and I'm sure it's all CGI, but I do know that they filmed – parts of this in Lithuania in a decommissioned reactor that was built around the same time as Chernobyl. So they didn't have to build as much set. They could kind of like fill it in with a little green screen and do what they needed to do. The other thing, which is really great about this series, well, first of all, the acting is phenomenal. I mean, Jared Harris is amazing. I would watch him read the phone book. He's amazing in this. But what's interesting what's becoming a trend in a lot of TV series I'm noticing is the integration of dark imagery that you would normally find in some of the better horror films. For example, they show a dying bird falling from the sky, and it really is both foreshadowing and metaphor. This is really a multi-leveled piece of work. I think it's going to bring awareness to the Chernobyl disaster. The guy who wrote this, Craig, it's been an obsession of his. He was the same age I was when this happened. So if you go on the HBO website and you do not have to subscribe to HBO to hear this part of it, there is a podcast that they have put together that they're going to put together after every episode. And in the first episode, they interview Craig, the writer, and he talks about things that he kind of took liberties with and why, and it's fascinating stuff. So if you're just interested in Chernobyl and you don't have HBO, I do encourage you to just go listen to that podcast. It's about 52 minutes long. It's really good.
Well, and I got to say, I watched the first episode too, Chrissy. And one of the things I'm finding interesting about it is not only is there the actual accident itself, but they're showing you that how much it was compounded by the people in charge lying their ass off trying to say, oh, there's nothing to see here, that really probably made the results of it much worse than they had to be.
How long is the episode, the first episode?
It's an hour. Each episode is an hour.
Also, another thing, did they talk about how – now that, you know, you look back, you know, whatever years later, how the Russian government did this, and yet it was the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian bureaucrats that got screwed over because of what the Russians did.
Well, we haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah, okay. We haven't gotten to that part yet, but Eric is right. And in fact, Eric, if you listen to that podcast, the writer talks a lot about how his main theme is in writing this, in telling this story, was the danger of lies and how the people who get hurt when lies go on are not necessarily the people who actually lied themselves.
Right, right.
It's the innocent bystanders, and he talks a lot about that. And also, he talks a lot about all of the different sources that they had to get things from, because some things have still not been declassified at some of this stuff. There's a wonderful book called Voices from Chernobyl, which is where he got a lot of his information, and that was eyewitness accounts of what happened. That book is terrifying. I read that book. It's terrifying. It's really scary. But I would encourage, you know, anyone who's interested in the series. I've already seen the episode twice because they've done so many wonderful little nuanced things. I wanted to go back and watch it a second time. But he clearly details what he took liberties with, why he took certain liberties, how important it was to stay as accurate as he possibly could to the real thing, because it is an homage to the thousands of people that died. And to this day, the official count is still like 31 dead or something.
I read a book about 20 years ago that was actually about by the guy who ran the Soviets, or probably ghostwritten with the guy who ran the Soviets' biological weapons program.
Wow.
And how they had, I think it was an anthrax leak in one of their plants. And, you know, people were just, when a whole bunch of people got sick and died, and they just said it was food poisoning. And they were amazed that the West just accepted it. It's like they didn't bother asking, why is it the only people who got sick from eating this tainted meat were males between the ages of, like, 25 and 50, you know. There are no children who ate the meat, no women who ate the meat. It was the factory workers were all the ones who got sick and died. But yeah, oh my God, they were so awful.
Well, and Pripyat was like...
Just about the lies, right? The secrets, the fear of admitting when there's something went wrong.
And the city of Pripyat was really the closest you could get to... what the Soviets had always hoped their Utopia would be, right? So that plays a factor in how that disaster played out too, because here you have people living in this city, which was beautiful. I mean, weather-wise, it was kind of like Connecticut for the Soviets. That was like a party, you know, because it was always freezing and horrible over there. But they had stores that were fully stocked, where you didn't have to wait in line for things like toilet paper or shoes. Nothing was rationed. You know, it was kind of funny because the writer said, I had some Ukrainians and some people that lived there at that time look over my script before we started production. And he said so that they would catch some of, you know, any inaccuracies and things like that, little stuff. And he said, one of the biggest things I got a note on was this woman said to me, okay, well, you have Legasov feeding his cat with pet food. And he goes, yeah. She goes, oh, no, there was no pet food in the Soviet Union. She's like, what are you, crazy? We fed them scraps. We barely had food for ourselves. There, you know, we didn't have pet food. Like, you know, and he said it just blew my mind in how the last 30, 40 years we've completely forgotten what a bad situation that country was in for its people. Like, they just didn't have anything. They had nothing. And so I think it's very relevant for today, too. So anyway, that's my thoughts on Chernobyl. If you're into it or even if you're not, it's just excellent. But it is real life horror and there is a lot in it that's going to make you really uncomfortable to watch. There's a lot in it that's going to make you cringe and there's a lot that's going to make you think, but it is excellent. It is definitely worth your time. I really hope to God they put this on DVD or Blu-ray because I want to buy it and I hope it has special features. The other thing I watched, which I'll be brief about, is I started the series Chambers on Netflix, which looks like a typical girl got transplant and now she's feeling things that the heart, the girl who gave her the heart, who died, feels. But, you know, it looked kind of interesting. Anyway, I said, well, this is cliched. It's been done, but I'm going to try it. It's wonderful. It goes way beyond. It takes that cliched idea and really does some interesting things with it. I'm only in episode 3, but I'm loving it, and I highly recommend that. So, anyway.
All right, very good. Excellent. And, Eric, you also do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called The Skancy Podcast. That's spelled S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, and Spotify.
Excellent. All right, sounds good. So let's give our final thoughts on We Need to Talk About Kevin. So let's start with you, Mike.
It's red. It's very, very red. It's like it is a very well crafted movie. It is a very interesting movie. It is a very tough and disturbing movie, and it will give you some things to chew on. Some people will hate having watched this film. You know, I won't recommend it to them. But yeah, as Phil pointed out earlier in the podcast, it is a it is. If you're listening to this podcast, you would probably like it. I honestly was really apprehensive about watching it again because it's just an uncomfortable film to watch. But once I started watching it again, it just kind of sucked me right back in. So, yeah, it's a high recommend with a great big asterisk after it.
All right. Sounds good. Let's go to Chrissy.
I really need to echo pretty much what Mike said. I think this is a film that'll make you think. It is really uncomfortable to watch. If you are sensitive, to, you know, some of the things that are happening in the news now with all of these school shootings, this may not be the film for you. Even though the focus is not on that, the movie does really examine, I think in a very deep psychological way, the whole phenomenon of what makes a person kind of go mad a little bit. So just be sensitive to what your threshold is. Also, if you don't enjoy movies that really are going to bother you and unsettle you, then yeah, stay away from this one. But I highly recommend it. I think the acting is wonderful. The storytelling is great. I love the fact that it's artful without being pretentious. Everything in here means something, and yet it is also very clearly communicated, but it's also a movie you need to pay attention to. If you look away, you might be like, oh my God, what the hell just happened? But very high on my list. I definitely recommend it.
All right, very good. For me, yeah, it was one of my top horror films of 2011. We classified it as a horror film that year that we did our first best of. I liked it so much that I actually did a guest host on the Horror Mafia podcast where they had me choose three films to discuss on the episode. And this
and then yelled at you for not picking horror films.
Yeah, well, Joey was okay with it. Joey was good. But the other three, yeah, they were like grumble. They were more thrillers than straight horror. That was fun to talk about the film there. And so when we were throwing out ideas and Eric said, all right, let's do this one. I was pretty happy. And it's definitely a great movie. It's a strange movie, too. It's kind of art housey, but a really good film. And I would highly recommend people to read the book as well. So high recommend. Eric.
This is a fantastic comedy. No, just kidding.
No. Look, they kill school children. You know I always love that.
I can't disagree with anything that's been said so far. I love this movie. I own this movie. If you're into dark material, definitely worth checking out. Yeah, so it's a high recommend for me.
Yep. Oh, and if you're a Tilda Swinton fan, for sure.
She's awesome. And I want to point out, if you're a Tilda Swinton fan, you can catch her right now on the latest episodes of What We Do in the Shadows.
That's true.
Okay. Very good. And what channel is that Shadows show on?
What We Do in the Shadows, FX.
FX, okay. Very good. All right. Sounds good. So, once again, we need to talk about Kevin. All four of us liked the film a lot. Three of us thought it was fantastic. One thought it was fantastic, but doesn't necessarily need to revisit. But all in all, that's a big thumbs up for a round. So, with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in to listen us talk about Kevin. Come back next week. We'll have another talk.
Never can forget the day when my dear mother did sweetly say, you are leaving, my darling boy. You always have been your mother's joy. Now as you leave, and if the words are wrong, you may not be able to get back home. But remember Jesus, who lives on high, is watching over you with a mighty eye. The world is so full of old sin and woe, and many sorrows everywhere you go. But remember Jesus, who's everywhere. You get in trouble now, he'll meet you there. If you bow down before his face and trust in him for his saving grace now. And you have a burden, he'll make them light, and he sure will guide you all in the right. My mother dear, how often she did not a chair. My wandering mind, quite gone astray. But saying, son, accept the way. Thank you.